Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of One Big Thing from Axios. Every week, I talk to leaders you know or need to know in business, politics, and culture.
We're not going to be changing the world if we don't take some risk.
We can't live burying our heads. This technology is here.
We're going about it the wrong way because we don't know the stuff to go for.
Interviews, ideas, and context all in 20 minutes or less. That's One Big Thing from Axios. Find us every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
The future of America is in your hands.
This is not a movie trailer, and it's not a political ad, but it is a call to action. I'm Mila Atmos, and I'm passionate about unlocking the power of everyday citizens. On our podcast, Future Hindsight, we take big ideas about civic life and democracy and turn them into action items for you and me. Every Thursday, we talk to bold activists and civic innovators to help you understand your power and your power to change the status quo. Find us at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to a bonus episode of What Could Go Right. I'm Emma Varvalukas, Executive Director of the Progress Network. This episode was recorded before the 2020 presidential election, but a lot of the discussion still applies today, so we hope that you find it informative. I'm Emma Varvalukas. I'm the Executive Director of the Progress Network. We're bringing together constructive public voices. You can find out more about us at theprogressnetwork.org. And since we're going to be talking about, among other things, social media today, you can also find us Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, see what we have to say on those channels. So today I'm with Robert Wright. He's a Progress Network member, author and writer. He's written several books, most recently, Why Buddhism is True. He runs the Non-Zero Foundation and writes the Non-Zero newsletter, which I highly recommend signing up for. And he also runs Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV, where he and other contributors talk politics, foreign affairs, philosophy, spirituality. It's really sort of an idea paradise. So I also recommend checking that out. So Bob, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, you know, we're obviously in this very intense political moment, intense political few years. And you've been talking since at least 2016, if not prior to that, about tribalism, specifically about tribalism on social media. So I want to talk about that problem. And then we're also going to talk about solutions, because I really want people to get an idea of how they can affect change for this in their own behavior, in their own lives. Mm-hmm. So to start with the problem, you wrote an article recently for your newsletter called Tips for Avoiding a Civil War, which I really, really, really liked, shared, very helpful for people. And in that, you laid out the problem, intertribal positive feedback cycle. What does that mean? And why do you think it's important enough to write about?
Well, you know, it starts with, I guess, two technological facts. One is that smartphone cameras are increasingly pervasive. The other is that social media allows you to get any image, including any video snippet, to anyone who would be interested in it, and increasingly to the people who are most interested in it and most emotionally intense in their reactions to it. So basically what you get is that if you think of the current kind of political alignment as two tribes, pro-Trump and anti-Trump, each tribe on social media tends to see the worst behavior of the other tribe. So if somebody with a MAGA hat is refusing to wear a face mask in a supermarket and throwing a fit and seeming irrational, that stands a pretty good chance of being captured on video and then being spread through social media to, you know, anti-Trumpers who are going to be most outraged by it. You know, you saw this during the, in a slightly different way, during the protests. People on the left tended to see the worst instances of police brutality, you know, in response to the protests. People on the right tended to see the most unruly law-breaking protesters. So, and you know, it's kind of natural to kind of assume, I mean, especially if you're already unfavorably disposed toward the other tribe, which is our predicament today, you are inclined to think of the horribly behavior horribly behaving person you're seeing from the other tribe as typical of that tribe, or at least as more typical than they actually are.
Are they not typical?
I think I can say in the case of people smashing protesters smashing windows, they're not typical, or there would be more broken windows. We can say in the case of police seeming to kind of try to like push forward with a car to the point of running over a protester, that's not typical. I mean, I think we probably would have seen it every time that happened, and I saw it once or twice. We don't know exactly how typical these things are, or how representative the sentiments they embody are. For example, there is a lot of resistance to wearing masks out there. I don't think a ton, but in any event, even if you look at those people, very few of them are going to just throw a fit in the supermarket, right? I think that's pretty atypical behavior. So, you know, and so the antipathy just gets amped up and up and up and up. The more evidence you see that seems to justify hating the other side, the more people in your own tribe are going to behave in ways that provoke hatred, right? Because they're going to get amped up, and a few of them are going to misbehave, and so on. So that's what I meant by kind of a positive feedback cycle.
Hmm. And just to clarify for people, I mean, we're not talking about video footage that really needs to be seen. I mean, you know, George Floyd comes to mind. It was recorded. People saw what happened. We're not talking about that. We're talking about something that's a little bit different, right?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of upsides to the pervasiveness of video, including exposing true cases of horrible behavior by police. I mean, I do think we still have to be careful in not assuming that any given act by any given police officer is representative of police officers broadly. But it's definitely a blessing in that regard that police have more trouble now getting away with brutality than they did. And believe me, it's a lot harder for them now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. That's a good thing. There are a lot of upsides, and I'm not like a Luddite. I'm not here to tell you that on balance, this technological environment is worse than the one I grew up with, although I do get nostalgic at times, but I definitely see real downsides to the old environment. I'm just saying that this particular dynamic I've tried to highlight is negative in ways that are worth keeping in mind.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a catchy title, the article that I mentioned, Tips for Avoiding Civil War, but do you really think that that's the direction that we're heading in with this positive feedback cycle?
I think, first of all, I don't think we would be likely to see a classic civil war of kind of a bunch of states against a bunch of other states. Because for one thing, red state versus blue state is a huge oversimplification. Most red states are at least 35% blue. Most blue states are at least 35% red. The split is more of an urban-rural or small urban-small-town, urban-rural split than a really red state-blue state split. But I do think if the question is, could you have a level of civil conflict, including a fair amount of killing, like some killing every day and ongoing killing, that's way worse than anything in my lifetime, I think the answer is yes. I think probably it won't happen, but I think kind of super bad outcomes are worth worrying about, even if they're not probable. But low probability catastrophic events are worth worrying about. And so, you know, that's why I just think it's worth, calling attention to the way we can all unwittingly become part of the problem just by reacting the way humans normally react to things, you know.
And in the context of social media, when you say react, I mean, we're literally talking about liking it, sharing it, commenting, like, fuck those guys, or whatever it is that you might comment or saying.
Yeah.
You know, so typical of a cop, or so typical of a Black Lives Matter person, or whatever it may be. Right. Which brings us into the solutions part, because you know, this, I think that sometimes when people talk about politics, it kind of feels like these, all these forces that are outside of our control, or even when people talk about the problems with social media, it feels like it's something that we're not actively contributing to when maybe we are. So what are the solutions? What kind of behavior can we instill in ourselves so that we don't add to this problem, or at least ameliorate this problem?
Well, for starters, there's a word I know you'll be familiar with since you were at Tricycle Magazine for a while, but it's mindfulness. In this case, that doesn't have to involve meditation. I'm an advocate of mindfulness meditation, but at a minimum, I'd suggest that when you're on social media, before you retweet something or like something, or before you weigh in and comment on something, especially before you comment antagonistically toward someone, kind of talking back to them, pause and try to reflect on what you're feeling, the feelings that are motivating the temptation to retweet, to share, to like, whatever. And ask yourself if it's a feeling that you should trust. You know, if the feeling is, you know, if you see that video of the person freaking out in the supermarket and going, yeah, those assholes, let's show the world what assholes they are. I mean, I'd be suspicious of that. I'd say, wait a second, how many of them actually are like that? And is it productive? What's going to happen as a result of this? I mean, clearly, even if I am conscious that this is not highly typical behavior, if I share it, lots of people will see it, and some of them will think it is highly typical behavior. So I'd say, think about the larger dynamic you're feeding into, reflect on the feelings that are motivating you, and ask yourself if the feeling itself is really caused to do what the feeling is telling you to do. I mean, my own view is you should only do things that makes sense. You know, I don't mean you can afford to govern your whole life, you know, like reflecting on every, every sandwich before you eat it.
Well, if you're a monastic, I guess.
well, yeah, I mean, and I'm not monastic, but I applaud monastic types. But I do think, you know, it's basically just try to be calm and circumspect and rational, and don't make the problem worse, for starters. Just, and that's in the case of your individual reaction to something on social media.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. That may be a Mark Twain quote, but it's just as true today as when he originally said it. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics is a podcast that compares and contrasts history to the current events of today. Host Bruce Carlson has recently done deep dives on fascinating topics like the fall of the Soviet Union, which sets the stage for today's geopolitics, the man who was in prison and still won a million votes for the presidency, and the mystery behind George Washington's involvement, or lack thereof, in the Bill of Rights. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics offers deep context to all these historic stories, especially those that you may think you know well, and is particularly adept at relating them to current events. So don't miss out. Listen to My History Can Beat Up Your Politics on all platforms. Hey, it's Emma. They say you should learn something new every day. It's good advice, but with so much to do in your daily life, how are you going to make the time to learn and stay curious about our world? Well, with Everything Everywhere Daily, you can easily make that goal an actual reality. Everything Everywhere Daily is one of the world's most popular daily education podcasts and a top 3 history podcast. In about 10 minutes, you can learn something new every day. The show covers history, science, geography, mathematics, and technology, as well as biographies from some of the world's most interesting people. Fans of the show are so passionate that you even work to join the Completionist Club, the group of dedicated listeners who have listened to every single one of the show's more than 1,000 and counting episodes. All of the episodes are informative, interesting, and best of all, always under 15 minutes. So go ahead, learn something new every single day with Everything Everywhere Daily. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I guess if you're not just going by the feeling of, oh, this is going to feel nice when I share this, and I feel correct in thinking that these people refusing to wear masks are terrible democratic citizens or whatever you may think. I guess the argument from there is like, maybe it is productive to share this so that I can show people that this is an issue. Don't people need to know that this is an issue?
You know, sometimes I think so. I think a good example of a tough case is violence during protests by either side, so on the one hand, people associated with a protest who are destroying property or engaging in violence. On the other hand, say maybe Trump supporters who are armed and are marching menacingly toward a protest, you know, we need to know that those things are happening. I guess the kind of question I ask in situations like that is there any danger in the current environment of an appreciable number of people not winding up knowing this is happening? Usually the answer is no, with things like this, given the current environment. So I usually just hold off. I'm not saying I'm doing a whole lot of good by holding off. In terms of actually doing good, I'm prouder of myself if I do something like, criticize somebody. I mean, especially like a major, you know, social media potentate with a lot of followers who seem to be kind of like grifters, you know, they're exploiting the current emotional environment to amass followers.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they are basically sometimes they'll say things like typical Trump supporter or, you know, when that's just clearly not true, then I like to weigh in and say, you know, this is obviously not a typical Trump supporter and it is not productive to do this. Or another case of criticizing people that are roughly on my side of the political spectrum, at least in the sense of being left of center. When I saw those videos of, there have been a couple of rounds of this where protesters presumed to be associated with Black Lives Matter in some sense of the term are like harassing diners or going in and demanding that diners, you know, hold up their hands in support of something or other. I mean, I really don't approve of like coercing people into publicly expressing opinions. I think this kind of thing just helps Trump. It fits right into his narrative. And so I like to point out that kind of thing. Like I'll say this, you know, this is just a gift to Trump when you're doing this. And look, I don't have enough social media clout to on any given day, like make the difference between the life of the Republic and the death of the Republic. But I just think we all have to, you know, take seriously what influence we have. That's the way we conduct our lives generally, right? I mean, if you see somebody you can help who's suffering, it's only one person. If you were Bill Gates, it would seem trivial because he can help millions, but you still helped him because that's what you can do.
I mean, it sounds like really what you're advocating for is this sort of like collective pause, you know, to get into the Buddhism a little bit. It reminds me of this one teacher who had something called the third moment method. And he was talking about like, if someone's really pissing you off, you take 3 moments before you react. Mm-hmm. And this seems like that plus like a dose of critical thought so that we're engaging a little bit more, well, mindfully, on social media than we're used to.
It's just pause and reflect. It's not easy though. And that's partly because some of these emotions are so subtle. I mean, sometimes it's just flat out, I hate that guy. That's not always easy to recognize, but sometimes it's just like, the feeling is more like, this is the right thing to do. That was bad behavior. I'm bringing it to light. I am serving justice. And you need to ask more questions of yourself before you can come anywhere near being sure that, you know, this is for the greater good. I mean, I do think, you know, as you know, that if you do practice mindfulness meditation and it works for you, you can actually get better at this and better at even detecting some of the subtler emotions and better at not following them, you know, better because they really take effect fast and motivate your behavior within a very narrow time frame. And the more you're in the practice of being mindful, the easier it will be to recognize that a given decision or a thought or perception is in fact being colored, if not governed, by a feeling.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, where do you see, and this is very apropos of the moment, misinformation fitting into this, like posts that are misinformation? Because I don't engage very much politically online. I do well, like
very
to...
wise. You're wise beyond your years.
Or I'm just tired or lazy. I do try to fact check people because I don't want to get into a political debate, but I think that if you're going to hold political views, you should at least have the correct facts at hand. But also I see myself being a little bit trigger happy and fact checking the other side a little bit more than fact checking my own side, because I don't want to seem like I'm unsupportive, which is sort of a dual question. So let's first say, how do you see misinformation fitting into this? And then, pushing back against that feeling of, oh, I'm doing something bad to my tribe if I push back on this, or if I make a critical statement or fact check.
Well, as for misinformation, I think often one of the main things that's spreading it is the cognitive bias known as confirmation bias, which a lot of people have heard of. It's like we are naturally attracted to information that seems to confirm our pre-existing worldview. We are less likely to seize on facts and even averse to facts that seem to contradict our worldview. It's a natural human tendency, you know, and that too. I mean, one of the insights from Buddhism that modern psychology has, I think, really corroborated is how finely the feelings are intertwined with thoughts and perceptions. And if you pay close attention to your behavior on social media, you'll see that a feeling is driving confirmation bias. If you see a fact that, yeah, that fits in, that's what I've been saying, that confirms what I've been saying, you'll feel that like you're like falling in love with it. You have a positive feeling toward the thing. You thirst for it. You cling to it. These are like, it's an infrastructure of feelings.
I'm right. It feels good. I'm so right.
It feels good. Yeah. And if you see information that seems at odds with your worldview, it'll make you kind of feel uncomfortable, and you'll start searching for reasons not to believe it, searching for reasons to discredit it, which may exist. That's certainly possible, but we tend to exaggerate them just as we are uncritical when we see information that supports our worldview. So for starters, I'll say that misinformation too is a problem that can be addressed somewhat through mindfulness, or just leave aside that, just pausing and reflecting. Now that leads to what isn't exactly the other question you asked, but is related, which is, but if my tribe does this and the other doesn't, isn't that like unilateral disarmament? That's a tough question. I mean, first of all, there is the argument that, like, in the long run, truth is a good thing. And lie, you know, misinformation and disinformation are not. But it's also true that given the current political polarization, there's a separate reason to try to fight misinformation, which is just that often, I'm not saying always, but often when your tribe is spreading the misinformation and clinging to it, you're ultimately going to reinforce the narrative of the other tribe. I mean, every time the anti-Trump side take something Trump says that's kind of ambiguous and on close examination doesn't really justify the worst reading of it. Every time they take something like that and do the worst reading of it and spread that, if you go look at the social media of the Trump side, they're like doing the close reading of it and giving you reasons to say, once again, those anti-Trumpers are lying about us. Mm. So I think fairly often, unilateral disarmament, so to speak, in the sense of fighting the misinformation spreading on your own side, can actually be good for your own side.
Okay. And what about that other question? Is it just coming down to being a little bit brave in pushing back against your own side when you see an error or something, like you're saying, that you were talking about before, where it doesn't match your values. Like you mentioned, protesters talking about murdering cops in your article.
There was a case in it was in D.C. and some speaker, again, it was, I guess this was a BLM protest. Some speaker was going like, basically the only, it's time to start killing cops. He had the microphone. He wasn't getting a very favorable reception, but he had the microphone. Mm. I think that kind of thing should absolutely be denounced. I don't think it takes as much courage to denounce that as it does to denounce some other things. But that's a case. Whenever you can accurately point out that something someone's doing probably is helping the other side, reinforcing their caricature of your side, I think that's a good way to put it to people. Now, it's also, I just think, morally wrong to kill people, including police.
Right.
And that's a fine thing to say, too. But, the broader question, does it take courage to push back against your own tribe? It does. And I often find it lacking in myself. I often don't push back when I should. I really don't like people hating me, and that's
who does
and it seems to come so fast and so intensely on social media. Now, as we all spend more years on social media, I think it's easier to get some perspective. Like I used to be super sensitive to what commenters said when I first started doing online videos like 15 years ago. And now I just don't, it barely touches me. And I think maybe we're all growing thicker skin in that regard or can try to, but I think that, the fear is something you need to fight in that case.
Yeah. And like we're saying, approaching it with a little bit more of a cool head, because I know from myself and others, like when I do decide to engage politically on social media, it does end up with this like stomach churning, heart beating. It just feels really icky. Yeah.
Now, again, that's the case where in principle, mindfulness meditation could help you deal with that, maybe even overcome it. But it's absolutely natural for it to be an issue.
Yeah. And I wanted to say too, so, we're filming this before the election. This might come out after the election. I mean, is this going to poof disappear if Biden wins? Is this suddenly like we don't need to worry about this anymore?
No, I don't think so. I think, the partisan polarization had been growing for some time before Trump. Some of the themes, the idea that some of Trump's themes, that liberals are snooty coastal elites who don't care about common Americans. I was hearing those 30 years ago from Republicans like Dan Quayle and probably Newt Gingrich. And Democrats have often been irresponsible. The problem has been getting worse and worse. I don't think it's going to go away overnight. I think it has been in some ways intensified by social media. I hope we'll get better at figuring out how to deal with social media, in some cases, maybe even govern them, or at least develop new norms that help us deal with them. But I don't think it's going away, especially since, Trump, as of now, as we tape this, Trump is laying the groundwork to call any loss by him illegitimate and rigged election and all that. And he's not going away. Even if he loses, I don't think he's going to get off of Twitter.
Right. Yeah.
I do think the good thing is it will be much easier if he's no longer president for the other side to resist his bait. We just won't care as much. And I think even, this may become explicit. I suspect that if he loses, the word will go out on social media and there will be something like agreement by progressives. I think that's at least a possibility, like just we're better off ignoring him unless he crosses a whole new line. And he's crossed so many now You know, how likely is that? But
you know, one thing I wanted to say is that you're talking about maybe we'll get used to social media and some norms will come into play. Maybe they'll be a little bit more regulated. Maybe I'm overly optimistic. But I feel like I do see some signs of at least attempts by social media organizations to govern the field of chaos a little bit, when before there's absolutely nothing, and it's certainly not great now. But it does seem to be a little bit like we're ever so slowly starting to turn around on that a little bit.
The social media companies are doing some things, but I think what they're not doing is contemplating the actual sacrifice of revenue, by which I mean, sure, at least in significant degree, by which I mean, you know, if you ask why do the algorithms drive some of this tribalization, it's because the algorithms maximize engagement. They want to keep me online, keep me clicking, retweeting, sharing. And if your algorithm is designed to do that and that alone without constraint, it is going to appeal to people's emotions. And that, especially in the current political environment, is going to include a lot of unproductive and even counterproductive emotions. And, you know, at a minimum, what I would like to see is algorithm transparency. That is to say, just a law. I mean, we sometimes forget we actually have the power to regulate corporations. Just a law that dictates that they show us all the code, and then create an API. I guess that stands for what? Something programming interface. But anyway, what it would allow is third-party companies. Like, see, what I would like to have is like dials, like just be able to, you know, have a little slider bars on my screen on Twitter. Like, say, I want to see less stuff that'll politically outrage me, or I want to see less violence, or I want to follow fewer people like this. It could go along any number of dimensions, but the point is what should be possible is for third-party software companies to create a dashboard like that. And then there would be competing dashboards and at least give us the power to fiddle with the algorithm. Why shouldn't we have that power? I mean, and then now that doesn't mean that everyone would use it wisely. Maybe a few people would say, I'm going to get more revved up and angry than I am, but I don't think so. And I think we have a right to know what's in the algorithms. Not that just seeing the code would give many of us much of a clue.
But people would translate it for those of us.
They would translate it. And moreover, the people who took advantage of the API to build the software, the dashboards, would be allowing us to make practical use of the transparency of the algorithm in ways we see fit.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I think there needs to be bigger solutions. In the meantime, this is why we were talking about today, that what you can do just as a regular Joe Schmo while we wait for the benevolent gods of Twitter and Facebook and so on to be a little bit more publicly conscious in the way that they run things. Well, that's it for me. Bob, do you have any other thoughts running through your mind that you'd like to share about this?
The only other thing I'd encourage people to resist is engaging with people from the other tribe antagonistically. I think you can do a real service if you engage, you know, with best intentions, honestly trying to understand where they come from, what their perspective is. And because what that can do is lead at least one person in the other tribe to think, well, I guess they're not all assholes over there. And that's progress.
Which does require the assumption that you go into that interaction not assuming that the other person you're talking to is an asshole, which seems hard these days.
Right, exactly. Assume the best. You may be wrong. They may be an asshole, but you have to go in there with the intention of, even if they act like an asshole, not responding in kind. I mean, it's just hard to imagine what actual good comes of that. I mean, you just make them madder, and how mad they are is already part of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a call to be bigger than our own emotions.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Bob, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. To find out more information about the Progress Network and what could go right, visit theprogressnetwork.org. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter to stay up to date with everything happening with the Progress Network. If you like the show, please tell a friend, share an episode, or leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast. What Could Go Right is hosted by Zachary Carabell and me, Emma Varvalukas. We're produced by Andrew Steven. Jordan Aaron is our production coordinator, executive produced by Jeff Umbro and The Podglomerate. Thanks so much for listening.